Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, new changes to SNAP are shifting more of the cost of the program onto New York counties, and that could mean your property taxes could go higher. We'll take a closer look at how much counties could have to pay, what it could mean for taxpayers and SNAP recipients. What sustainable harvesting means for forest health, the Northern Tier Hardwood Association preparing for its third annual sustainable timber harvesting event in Pennsylvania. We'll find out why the organization says responsible forest management matters. The Upper Delaware Council announces its 2026 River Valley Award honorees. We'll talk with UDC Executive Director Lori Ramey. Plus, NPR is inviting people ages 65 and older to take part in its first senior podcast challenge. And live music and storytelling at Catspan. After the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Trump will travel to Texas today to headline a fundraiser for Republican Senate candidate Ken Paxton. As he campaigns for fellow Republicans, some members of his own party are pushing back on parts of his economic agenda. His tariffs on Canada and a plan to increase beef imports are drawing criticism from Republican senators, including some facing difficult elections this fall. NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports.
With the tariffs on Canada, that led to some Republicans who are running in some really tight elections, like Senator Susan Collins in Maine, to distance herself from Trump, say that these tariffs are a mistake. And Trump recently also announced that the U.S., this is a different move, would import more beef from abroad. That was an effort to try and lower the cost of beef, which has increased in part because of the war.
That's NPR's Deepa Shivaram reporting. The jury is expected to begin deliberating today in the murder trial of Lindsay Clancy. Deborah Becker from member station WBUR reports the Massachusetts woman is charged with killing her three children in 2023.
Before deliberations begin, both sides will have an hour each to make closing arguments. The defense claims Clancy had postpartum psychosis and should not be held criminally responsible. Defense attorney Kevin Reddington says Clancy is hopeful.
And she feels that she's had a fair trial with the judge and the jury's been very attentive, and all we can do is hope for the best.
Prosecutors argue that Clancy did not have psychosis and was mentally well enough to follow the law. The case has focused international attention on mental health, especially for new mothers. For NPR News, I'm Deborah Becker in Plymouth, Massachusetts.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the number of cases of cyclosporiasis in the U.S. continues to rise. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports more than 17,000 illnesses have been confirmed thus far.
This year's spread of cyclospora, which causes diarrhea, dwarfs previous foodborne illness outbreaks from the boar's head listeria outbreak 2 years ago, or the jack-in-the-box E. coli outbreak in the early 1990s. Sandy Eskin is CEO of the advocacy group Stop Foodborne Illness.
It's off the charts. I don't think we've ever had an outbreak with this many illnesses.
Experts say recent cuts across government to public health and food safety systems, as well as the consolidation of food production, have made it harder to anticipate and respond to outbreaks. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
Stocks open mixed on Wall Street this morning. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 15 points. The Nasdaq Composite up 252. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. An ICE officer charged in a Minneapolis shooting has been released from a Texas jail after a judge rejected a bid from Minnesota for immediate extradition. Christian Castro is facing 4 assault counts and a charge of falsely reporting a crime in connection with the January shooting of an unarmed Venezuelan man. Texas law required Castro's release after 90 days in custody unless he was extradited. Officials in Minnesota say they'll continue trying to bring him back to face the charges. 2 weeks after a severe storm caused widespread power outages in northwest Indiana, utility officials say restoration efforts are mostly complete. But as Barb Anguiano of member station WFYI reports, some residents remain without power.
NIPSCO announced on their website Wednesday crews would continue working through individual outage cases. James Eisen is a contractor and lives in Hobart, Indiana. He says his neighbor still doesn't have electricity due to damage from trees. Eisen says he's frustrated with the lack of urgency on NIPSCO's part.
They're still out of power. Yeah, and you can see that there's still people still hurting. And that makes no sense to me.
NIPSCO currently faces a class action lawsuit alleging the utility failed to manage vegetation as well as conduct adequate inspections of utility poles and power lines. Indiana Governor Mike Braun has asked Indiana's utility watchdog to seek an investigation into NIPSCO. For NPR News, I'm Barb Anguiano in Gary.
I'm Windsor Johnston, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. New York counties are preparing to take on a larger share of the cost of administering the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, or SNAP, following cuts in federal support. New York Focus reports the shift could add $168 million a year in administrative costs statewide beginning in October, with counties potentially facing an even larger bill in 2027 when they begin paying a portion of SNAP benefits. For counties, that could mean higher property taxes, cuts to other services, or both. New York Focus reporter Jenny Zhao reports on social services and public benefits and has been examining the changes and their potential impact. She spoke with Jason Dole yesterday.
So last summer, Congress passed the One Big Beautiful Bill, and basically this implements multi-years of federal cuts for a wide variety of public benefits, and that includes SNAP, also known as food stamps. And as a result of that declining federal support, the states are having to figure out where to come up with all this extra money. And in New York, that is happening with the SNAP program. And New York has decided to actually put a lot of those costs onto counties, which is actually quite unique. There's only about three states, including New York, that has decided to do it this way.
So we're going to talk about like how counties are dealing with that, but have counties pushed back at all? Are counties continuing to respond to this or saying anything about, well, why is New York doing it this way, or is that ship already sailed?
I mean, yes, they're still lobbying for the state to try to either pick up some of these costs. They're also lobbying Congress to see if they could delay this whole thing. So this has been going on in Washington, D.C. There's been a lot of pressure on multiple states, not just New York, to try to get Congress to roll back these changes or delay these changes. So far, that has not happened. Locally at the state level, there was a lot of hope that Governor Hochul would have the state absorb these costs at least temporarily or permanently. That also hasn't happened. I'm told that the lobbying efforts are ongoing, but so far it's looking like this is going to be falling to counties to pick up the tab.
I apologize that I just jumped in talking about SNAP as though everybody knows exactly what that's about, but this is really your beat. You cover social services and public benefits for New York Focus. So can you talk a little bit about the importance of SNAP, what it is and what it does for folks, and what the cuts to it is really threatening?
Yeah, for sure. So SNAP is one of the most successful sort of federal public benefit programs in the country. It spans multiple decades, and it basically feeds hungry New Yorkers. There are over 2.7 million New Yorkers who are enrolled in the program. Last year, the average household received $376 in monthly benefits. So this is what you can use to buy groceries, pantry staples, basically what you need to keep your family fed. And this program is kind of known as a very successful program in the sense that it is also an economic boon. So all these stores and the retailers that are part of the SNAP network also make a lot of money from being in the program. So it's often billed as a win-win. And so in this situation, you know, New York State as a whole, like many states since the pandemic, has really seen food insecurity rise. And so you're talking about cutting back these critical safety net food assistance benefits at a time when there are more and more households reporting that they're food insecure.
So there's these cuts at the federal level. The states have to deal with that. New York State has decided that the when it comes to these benefits, counties are going to have to deal with it. And you've got in this article one of those great, I love these interactive infographics that New York Focus does, showing exactly how much New York counties are about to pay for SNAP. What do you see when you look at this breakdown of what each county's shortfall is going to be?
So it really depends on how many residents in that particular county are enrolled in SNAP and the amount of benefits they receive. And basically what this is going to amount to is that counties with a higher proportion of poor residents are likely going to pay more. So it's a really wide range here. And that's because, you know, the counties in our state really vary by population and also by, you know, income. So for instance, the very low end, you have $27,000 a year in rural Hamilton County, where there's only a few hundred residents. I believe a little bit over 300 people are on SNAP in that county. And then you have on the upper end, $111 million a year in New York City, where you have 1.7 million residents currently enrolled in SNAP. And again, these annual figures that I just threw at you, that is just for one SNAP cost that the as a result of declining federal support. This is the change that is going to be taking place this October, so within just a few weeks from now. Starting next year, the potential liability on counties is really going to balloon. And you're talking about counties, even the smaller counties, being responsible for maybe $1 million annually. So for instance, the new change that takes effect this October, collectively, the state counties will be responsible for $168 million per year. But next year, on top of that, the state's counties will be collectively responsible for over $1.1 billion annually. So we're talking about a massive shift. But all in all, when I talk to counties, they have no idea where this money is going to come from.
They already don't know where the money is going to come from. You're saying next year it's going to be like 5.5 to 6 times more.
Yeah.
Oh, my
correct.
Goodness.
Yeah. So right now they have figured, they've basically, you know, most counties budget on the calendar year. So right now they are okay to sort of pay this initial cost increase that takes effect in October, all the way through the end of 2026. But the counties that I spoke with, they have no idea what they're doing in 2027. And that's where the numbers start to get really, really large. And for the most part, you know, counties are not like the state. They have very limited mechanisms to raise revenue. For the most part, they really have just one thing, property taxes. And so a lot of the county advocates that I spoke to about this, they were basically like, you know, people should care about this because it's going to be taxpayers that pay this, New Yorkers, basically, in the form of property taxes. And that means, you know, if you own property, real estate, but also if you rent too, because, you know, as everyone knows, as any renter knows, if your landlord's costs go up, your costs go up as well.
Right. So there may be like a delayed impact as to when like a majority of New Yorkers start noticing the issue here. I mean, you're reporting on this. You've been seeing this come for a while, but maybe there is a majority of people there that aren't realizing how this might impact them.
Correct. Yeah, because counties are just starting to plan their budgets for 2027. It's literally in the course of the next couple of weeks or months where you might start seeing county governing boards, you know, meeting and voting to decide whether or not they need to raise their property taxes. And then it could be months down the line where, you know, you as a resident in a particular county will receive a letter in the mail being like your taxes are rising. And I think it's going to be really hard for people to connect those two things together. But again, this is all a consequence of congressional legislation that was passed last summer, so a whole year ago.
Can you give us any examples of what the folks that you talk to from individual counties are telling you?
Yeah. So for the most part, it is a big struggle for a lot of counties to figure out where extra money is going to come from. So I spoke to a couple of counties, and Washington County, which is near the Capitol, this year already, it raised their taxes, and that is really just to cover the declining federal support of various programs, including programs like SNAP, but also Medicaid. So for Washington County, it's projected that the county will have to pay an additional $500,000 this year, for the full next year with this new cost increase. And as a result, to try to, make their budget work, they've essentially, the county's Department of Social Services, which oversees SNAP, has had to basically not fill any vacant positions. So you're talking about the agency that is having to administer SNAP, not being able to backfill empty positions. And this is an agency that's had to deal with a whole host of other changes to SNAP. So I've reported a lot about all the eligibility changes that have been happening in recent months, in addition to all this county funding gap situation. And so that's already been really stressful at the county level. And now it's just going to get even more stressful because they're going to have to come up with money that they really don't have.
You also checked in the Catskills and Hudson Valley with Ulster County. Can you tell me a little bit about what they're planning to do?
Yeah. So Ulster County is a very interesting case study because they have made a decision to basically avoid property tax increases. They've managed to avoid property tax increases apparently since 2012. The county executive has proposed what basically a wealth tax. You've probably heard that a lot. That concept of a wealth tax became really popular under New York City Mayor Mamdani, right? It's the idea of taxing higher earners and being able to use that revenue to offset all these federal cuts that are happening to a lot of people who are in poverty, right? So Ulster County has proposed a surcharge that would raise income taxes by as much as 2% on their highest earners. And they basically believe that if they got the approval to do that, they would be able to offset, these additional SNAP costs, which in Ulster County are projected to be as much as $738,000 a year just for the costs that start in October. And then next year, that'll go up to over $8 million a year. So they're really having to think of where to come up with a lot of money very quickly. The thing is, with this proposal, they need state approval, and that is not going to happen until the lawmakers return back to Albany for the legislative session in January. So they are kind of hopeful that they're going to get that approval. And it's a very unique approach to doing this. And their idea is that when I spoke with County Executive Jen Metzger about this, she mentioned that she wants to avoid the regressive nature of property taxes, right? So it's the idea that raising property taxes, again, is just going to sort of exacerbate local housing costs. And that is the case in Ulster County, where they have a large amount of their residents who are housing burdened, meaning they spend a very large share of their paycheck just on housing and basic necessities.
Yeah. So you say Jen Metzger called this a modest step towards creating a fair system, given that background where people are spending at least half their income on housing and basic necessities, with Metzger saying, quote, "Everyday people simply can't afford to shoulder a disproportionate share of the cost of funding essential government services," end quote, from Ulster County Executive Jen Metzger. Jenny, this story is really about how government is dealing with government issues and how local government is dealing with a state and national problem. I'm wondering, in this story or at this moment, what can you say about how this is impacting the people who need the SNAP benefits? How are they doing right now?
I mean, overall, nationally, enrollment in SNAP is down. It's still too early to say, like, if that's a consequence of, you know, the big, beautiful bill and a potential sort of a chilling effect that all the discussion around SNAP and SNAP cuts has had maybe on SNAP uptake. But we know that overall enrollment in the program is down. And that is despite, like, food insecurity metrics all being up. So it's not the sense that there are less people using SNAP because they are not experiencing food insecurity. On the contrary, everything indicates that food costs are still a really big struggle for many households across the country. So any sort of changes to this program where you make it really difficult for local governments to balance their books, there's always going to be the fear that you're undercutting the program itself. So as I mentioned, in the case with Washington County, they are literally having to make up some of this cost by not filling certain positions at their social services department, which administers this program. So it almost has like this negative feedback loop kind of attached to it. What I'll also say is that New York is in the minority in a lot of different ways in this case. So as I mentioned, there are just three states right now that have decided to have counties pick up the tab instead of using dedicated state funding to cover these gaps. But New York is even more sort of in the minority when you consider that one of those other states is New Jersey, our neighbor. and their governor actually, during their budget cycle earlier this year, decided to at least just use state funds to cover the costs over the next year. And this is basically to give their counties a transition period so that the counties are not sort of scrambling as they are now to try to, you know, raise property taxes and do all these things in the interim. So it gives them an extra year to figure things out. And I'll also say New Jersey also in their budget established a minimum monthly SNAP benefit of $95 per household. There were similar efforts in New York during the budget cycle earlier this spring, and they just did not gain traction. So in a way, like, New York is kind of making these decisions where there is a lot of vulnerability to SNAP as a program, and there's been an argument made by a lot of anti-hunger advocates that the state just hasn't done as much as you would expect a state like New York with the kind of economic power it has to do. And it's been really interesting as a reporter to see how other states have sort of approached this, and including our neighbor, New Jersey.
Gia Jenny Zhao covers social services and public benefits for New York Focus, and we've been talking about her most recent article reporting on the fact that by the end of next year, New York could be paying over $1 billion a year to keep SNAP running, and those costs for now are falling on the counties. Jenny, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, the third annual sustainable timber harvesting event in Pennsylvania. We'll learn more about it after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills. From inpatient and outpatient care to primary, urgent, and specialty care with Garnet Health doctors in Sullivan County. Exceptional lives here. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, Hollywood star Anthony Ramos opens up about leaving New York for Miami, recording a salsa album in English, and very openly talking about his mental health meltdown.
Your career to everyone looks like one thing, but your personal life, it was really hard for me to look at myself in the mirror and be like, I like that guy.
That's this week on Latino USA. Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Pennsylvania's hardwood industry will be in the spotlight next month as the Northern Tier Hardwood Association hosts its third annual sustainable timber harvesting event at Bear Creek Camp in Wilkes-Barre. The five-day event gives the public, students, and government and conservation officials a firsthand look at forest management, sustainable harvesting practices, and the equipment used in today's timber industry. Shelby Chorba is program manager for the Northern Tier Hardwood Association, and she joins us now with more. Welcome, Shelby.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, tell us a little bit more about the Northern Tier Hardwood Association and your sustainable timber harvesting event. What do you want people to understand about Pennsylvania's forest industry?
So we are a nonprofit hardwood utilization group. There's actually three of us that cover kind of half of Pennsylvania. So I cover 11 counties in northeastern Pennsylvania, including Wayne County, Lackawanna. We go all the way over to Tioga County and kind of everything in between in that northeastern corner. We have a volunteer board of 11 industry and conservation members and one full-time employee, which is myself. We are our membership. We have foresters, loggers, you know, all parts of the industry, but also forest landowners and just people that kind of want to support the forest industry. And we do have membership from New York State as well. So we do a lot. We do a lot of these educational events, this one that's coming up, but just promoting an education on sustainable forest management and the use of wood products. We do a lot of public outreach, provide workforce development opportunities and industry trainings like chainsaw safety trainings. And we also do advocacy in Harrisburg and Washington, D.C., you know, for our members and for industry as a whole. So kind of all of that together, we combine it for this big event that we do in the fall. September 27th is the first day on Sunday is going to be the public day. So anyone is welcome to come to that. It's 10 to 4, like you said, at Bear Creek Camp in Wilkes-Barre. And then the other 3 days, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we bring schools in, high schools and colleges. And then Thursday is our legislative and conservation day. And that starts at 10 a.m. So... Go ahead. If you have anything, yeah, I can keep going.
No, I know. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about timber harvesting and explain that to folks. What does sustainable harvesting actually look like in practice?
Yeah. So we, as loggers and foresters wanting to do sustainable forest management, we usually try to make sure that there is already regeneration or trees growing, you know, before we want to do a harvest. So that obviously means sustainable. We know that there's trees that are going to be established when we do, you know, come in and take some out. So we're not going through and, you know, just cutting trees to cut trees. We want to make sure that we have some there, you know, for future generations. So it's basically that. And there's a lot more to it. There's a lot of science to it, and different, you know, depending on what species you have and invasive species as well, it kind of determines, you know, how you're going to go about that management. But essentially, that's the gist of it, is just making sure that you have regeneration, you know, before you do a cut.
And at that event on September 27th, you'll be demonstrating how a timber harvest can actually improve forest health. What are some of the things attendees will see in the woods that illustrate that connection?
Yeah, so this is our third year, we're actually, you know, in the same area that we have done a harvest for these past 3 years. So we're able to see that regeneration growing from, you know, the previous cuts, and we're able to see if there are invasive species and what we may need to, you know, take out, because the invasive non-native plants that are there will hinder our natural growth, our, you know, our native species. So all in all, it affects the forest health. So, you know, we touch on all of that. We walk through and see what we have done and see what's growing. So there's a forestry station that we have Deer Park Lumber foresters talking about, and DCNR service foresters talking about, you know, different types of forest management. And then we actually take them into where we have done the previous harvest, for the past 2 years. And then show them chainsaw felling, and then show them new mechanized harvesting, which is, you know, big technical machines. And then we'd kind of go and do touch a little bit on like secondary manufacturing with a portable sawmill and a firewood processor, Just a, you know, just a little bit, because we're outside, so it's hard to show that part of it, but we try to touch on it a little bit.
And let's give people the details again where they can get more information. And what do you hope folks take away from the whole event?
Sure. So more information, our website is nthardwoods.org, or you can just search us, Northern Tier Hardwood Association, and we're usually that first link that comes up. And then we have an events page, and all the information is there, and email and phone number. You can reach me. That's on there. And we're just hoping, we'd really like to, one, anybody interested in their environment, we want to share how important working forests are to our environment, to the forest health, and to our health and our economy in Pennsylvania. Our forest industry is the number one sector of our agriculture industry, actually, in Pennsylvania. So a lot of people don't know that, and we would just like to, you know, share how important it is, and then get students, or maybe get a future workforce, get people interested in the industry, and kind of come and join us and work in the woods.
That's Shelby Chorba, Program Manager for the Northern Tier Hardwood Association. Shelby, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
Coming up, we'll hear from Upper Delaware Council Executive Director Lori Ramey about this year's River Valley Award honorees. This is Radio Chatskill.
This week on CatsCast, a continuation of last week's conversation with Judy Van Putt and Nick Lyons, wading even deeper into the life and legacy of Ed Van Putt, Catskills angler, author, and presidential river guide.
He was told that the president wants to fish before dinner. He came in his waders, took his waders off, and immediately started shaking hands.
Saturday at 11 a.m. right here on Radio Catskill.
Early radio enthusiasts discovered something about shortwave broadcasting.
Radio waves are sent out in all directions.
That was different from AM and FM.
When these waves strike the antenna of a receiving set, we hear sound originating at that very moment, hundreds or even thousands of miles away.
Long live the shortwaves on this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Saturday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. The Upper Delaware Council is preparing to honor individuals, organizations, and community groups for their contributions to the Upper Delaware River Valley. The UDC's 38th Annual River Valley Awards are set for September 13th in Beach Lake, Pennsylvania, with this year's honorees including rescuers, volunteers, cultural organizations, and community advocates. Joining us now is Lori Ramey, Executive Director of the Upper Delaware Council, to talk about this year's awards and the people and organizations being honored. Lori, welcome.
Hi, thanks, Tim.
Let's start with the awards themselves. Remind folks the purpose of the awards and what do they say about the people and the organizations that make up the Upper Delaware River Valley?
Yes, this is actually the only awards program which honors people on both sides of the river in our Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational River Valley. And we really try to find the unsung heroes out there that might not get noticed every day, but make significant contributions to our way of life and protecting our resources. And of course, keeping our visitors safe and everyone happy to be where they are to get to enjoy such a beautiful resource. So this year, we're particularly leaning into the semi-quincentennial theme. And why not? Our keynote speaker is John Conway, who, of course, is the official Sullivan County historian, but the unofficial historian for the Upper Delaware River Valley. There's really no subject that he can't cover. He is amazingly impressive. And he'll be talking in his remarks about the impact of the Revolutionary War and that era on the River Valley specifically. And then some of our honorees just happen to fall into that theme as well. We're honoring the Fort Delaware Fife and Drum Corps with our Cultural Achievement Award for all that they've done in the past couple years to form from absolutely nothing to a volunteer musician group, which has performed at so many events and parades and programs in the past couple years and really just, you know, solidified that role of American heritage music in the area. So we understand that we may even be graced with a performance by the Fife and Drum Corps. We don't usually have entertainment per se, but this year we are happy to have that. Then we also have the Coshecton Celebrates America's 250th Anniversary Committee. This is a small town that really took to heart this opportunity they had to look at their history locally, and they've been having events in all five hamlets within the town to have people come together and share their stories of growing up there, or industries that they remember, and people and contacts. So they're receiving the Outstanding Community Achievement Award. And that's just a couple examples of how this theme is carrying through this year's program.
And you're also honoring two groups for rescues on the Delaware River, one at Skinner's Falls, another in Matamoros. Can you tell us a little bit about the significance of honoring these folks who are rescuing folks on the river?
Yes. Actually, both of these incidents happened on July 4th, and obviously that's a very popular time for visitation on the river, but also we obviously get a lot of people that may not be familiar with the dangers that the river can represent in terms of the steep drop-offs and the current and how it looks somewhat close to go from one side to the other of the river, but people don't realize that that's a very dangerous thing to do, to try to swim across. So in the cases that we're representing, we're fortunate to have the National Canoe Safety Patrol, which has volunteer members that every single day and weekend they are out there helping the National Park Service, which is stretched thin by having only so many rangers available for the 73.4 miles of river, to really assist in keeping an eye on the safety of people. And they had an issue this July 4th with an individual who fell out of a raft, basically, and his foot became stuck under a rock, and the river swells were coming up over his head. And it's a very dangerous situation to try to untangle yourself from that type of entrapment. So they had to employ some citizen help of people who were there on the shore and on the river, and also just get their forces together, use all the training that they have to get that person free from the rock and from the danger. Mm-hmm. And in the other situation, there was a swimmer who did not actually know how to swim, it turns out, who just found himself bobbing up and down in the river and gasping for air. And five young ladies who were rafting just on a pleasure trip, who are local residents, came to his aid. And that could have turned out very poorly as well. That particular award is named after Robin M. Daniels, who was a National Park Service ranger who died in the line of duty answering an emergency ambulance call. And the award is very special to her family and to the legacy of the Park Service.
So many great people being honored and awards given out. For people who might want to attend, what should they know about this year's ceremony coming up September 13th? And you've got a deadline to get tickets, I think, coming up.
We do. And September 1st is that deadline. And it's sometimes difficult when you're flipping the calendar into a new month to remember that that's next Tuesday.
That's
folks.
Tuesday, folks.
Yes. And we would ask, for the sake of our venue and having to plan for the food orders, et cetera, that people let us know if they're interested in attending. It's very much a public banquet in which everyone there is paying tribute to these nine categories of awards. And the tickets are available at $42 per person, or $43 if you do a PayPal online payment. And we just need you to submit your name to us through any means that you choose. Go to upperdelawarecouncil.org and you will see a reservation form. And it's also on our Facebook page.
That's Lori Ramey, Executive Director of the Upper Delaware Council. The UDC's 38th Annual River Valley Awards Ceremony, September 13th at the Central House Family Resort in Beach Lake, Pennsylvania. And again, reservations are due Tuesday, September 1st, information at upperdelawarecouncil.org. Lori, thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting us.
Now, podcasting has made it possible for just about anyone to become a storyteller, and NPR is looking for stories from a generation they have that may have decades of experiences to draw from. They've launched the Senior Podcast Challenge, inviting people age 65 and older to create and submit an original podcast. I spoke with NPR's senior editor Steve Drummond and producer Janet Woyoung Lee about the NPR Senior Podcast Challenge. Steve, I want to start with you. NPR has run the Student Podcast Challenge for years. What did you hear or see in those competitions that made you think there were some storytelling opportunities for folks 65 and older?
Yeah, great question. We noticed over the years that some of the best student podcasts we got were ones where young people interviewed their elders. A grandparent who had some involvement with historical events, or a member of the community who had an amazing immigration story, or people sort of exploring their own world and their own community through the experiences of you know, sort of their seniors. And so at a certain point, we started thinking, geez, maybe we should just see what, you know, cut out the middle person and see what seniors have to say on their own. And so we're kind of excited to see what happens.
There are roughly 60 million Americans 65 and older. What do you think this generation has to say that isn't necessarily being heard in the broader conversation about aging?
Yeah, like Steve mentioned, in previous years from our Student Podcast Challenge, we received stories from seniors who share their stories, retellings of historic events that we don't often get to hear through that first-person perspective. A couple of years ago, we had a really wonderful student podcast from San Jose where this middle schooler interviewed a survivor of the Japanese incarceration camps. So those are kind of stories that we're interested in. Also, you know, stories of new adventures, of love, new relationships, kids, grandkids. We also had a lovely college podcast from a couple of years ago. Actually, the first year we opened the college contest, of a student in her 60s who returned to college. So not just stories that are necessarily about grief and grieving, which obviously are a huge part of their experiences. But yeah, I think we are really excited about the full spectrum. And a big part of our contest is that it's truly open topic. So any story that folks are excited about, passionate about, maybe it's a project you've been working on for a long time, or this sparked your interest in trying podcasting for the first time, we're just excited to listen to any and all of it.
I just want to ask you a little bit more about what makes a good story. Is there a common thread you're looking for despite this wide range of subjects? The examples NPR gives range from retirement and healthcare to family history, romance, travel. you know, it's open, as you said. But is there something that you're looking for that links them, or what makes a good story for you guys?
Yeah, we've listened to over the years now, we've listened to thousands of student podcasts. And I think there's one thing that kind of unifies them all is that when the storyteller has a passion or an enthusiasm, they're really excited about the story they want to tell and they want to bring it to us. That's one thing. But the other thing I think is when there's some personal connection to this story. In other words, there are giant broad topics like you just mentioned, like healthcare or retirement, you know, sort of talking in general about those things sounds sort of like a book report or a term paper. But when you have a specific connection or you're telling a story in which you are personally involved or you're personally engaged with, those we find are the podcasts that really stand out for us.
Talk a little bit about how important the storyteller's own voice and personality are. Are you looking for something polished or is authenticity more important than technical perfection?
We're a big fan of authenticity, I'd like to say. When it comes down to, even in our judging criteria, storytelling and structure is a huge part, I think, in total 80%, whereas production is 20%. So I say this because if you're worried about the technical aspect, maybe it's your first time trying to use Voice Memos app, opening up a laptop and trying new editing softwares, I really, really wouldn't worry. I think we're really just looking for any story you have to tell. And even some of the rough edges, I think, are charming. We get that a lot with our student podcasts where it's so clear that kids are recording in the lunchroom, the gym like classes where things are echoing, but it like still takes us exactly where you are and we get a sense of your experiences and what story you're trying to tell. So that's what we want to prioritize.
So let's give some more advice to prospective podcasters. Maybe there's someone listening right now who's 70 or 80 and thinks, I have a story, but I have absolutely no idea how to make a podcast. Where should they start, Janet?
Yeah, I would start by reading our big announcement page that lists out all the rules. which you can find at npr.org/senior podcast challenge. If you are worried about just podcasting, like how to get started, the technical stuff, or even just the beginnings of what story to tell, we have a big resources page that's called NPR Sound Advice. And that will walk you through every step of the way, starting from what makes a good audio story all the way to how to record yourself and how to use free softwares that we provide examples on. So yeah, we, like Steve and I, really, really try to make this accessible for anyone who's interested, for students and now for our seniors. So I hope you find all our resources easy to follow. And if you have any questions, you can reach either of us. That's at seniorpodcastchallenge@npr.org, and we will make sure to get back to you.
How much equipment does someone actually really need? Can they actually just do it on their smartphone?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that. I think a lot of people mistakenly think you need some fancy studio or an expensive microphone or something like that. We found over the years, and it really works, using the voice memo app or some other easy app on a smartphone, and then a laptop computer with some editing software that you can get often free on the internet. There are lots of them out there. That's really all it takes to make a fine podcast. And we've learned at NPR in the last few years since the pandemic that, you know, we can do podcasts and we can do audio storytelling from all, you know, from a closet or a quiet bedroom or somewhere where there's just, you know, no sound. It really doesn't take a lot of technology to do this. And not that there's not a learning curve, but as Janet said, we've got a lot of that stuff online.
Steve, you spent years working with NPR's podcasts and podcast challenges. Do you see this as simply a contest, or is there a larger goal here of encouraging older people to become storytellers and producers of their own media?
Oh, very much so. We've seen it. We've been so surprised with our young listeners, our student podcasters. So many of them say, oh, I never heard of a podcast before, and end up winning. Or we've introduced tens of thousands of young people to audio storytelling, to journalism, and to, you know, what we all do at NPR and our member stations. And we're kind of hoping for the same thing from seniors. I think this is a group of people that has very unique experiences and different and special issues they're facing. And we're hoping that this might be a way for people to try something new, take on a new experience. And already Janet and I are getting a lot of emails, really fascinating emails from people with questions about the contest. And it looks like, so far, it looks like it's going to be fun.
And just want to remind folks of a couple of specific rules about submissions. They need to be original, and AI can't be used in writing or presentation. Are there other restrictions like copyrighted music? What should people know before starting to add any kind of music or audio to their podcast?
Thanks for asking. Other than the ones you've listed, when it comes to time, we ask entries be no longer than 8 minutes. And like you mentioned, there's guidelines around music and copyrighted audio, which we just want to make sure we can air your work and share your beautiful stories with the NPR audience. So just asking folks to be mindful of not using anything that's copyrighted material.
And Janet, if someone's listening now and says, I've been meaning to tell this story for years, what would you say to convince them to hit that record button?
Ooh, just go for it. Anyone can make a podcast. We really believe anyone has a story to tell and anyone can make a podcast. And we've had many first timers be the winner, be finalists. And that can be you. And that can be you coming to Washington, D.C. to listen to your story air live on Weekend Edition. So, yeah, please send us your stories.
And Steve, when you sit down with Jana and the judges to start listening to these submissions, what do you think will make you say we need to hear this story on NPR?
Oh, the surprise is the best thing. We, you know, with our student podcasters, we get a lot of fairly predictable ones. And then every now and then you're listening to 10, 20, 30 of them, and there's something that just jumps out. And the fun part is it's something that we never would have predicted, a story that we never would have thought of ourselves, all kinds of things like that. You just, the simple factor of surprise or finding just some joyful piece of sound or tape in these stories. That is the fun of us for Janet and I. And I think it's the fun for our NPR audience who get to hear these, you know, twice a year.
That's NPR senior editor Steve Drummond and producer Janet Wu-Yong Lee about the NPR Senior Podcast Challenge. More information at npr.org. Thank you both so much.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up, we'll talk more about this year's Catspan Festival. Cultural reporter Valerie Manzi has the story next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, Laverne Cox, Emmy-nominated actress and transgender activist. She'll talk to filmmaker Cheryl Dunier. We'll also hear Haitian-American writer Edwidge Danticat on her new novel, Day. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
It's Radio Chatskill, and cultural reporter Valerie Manzi spoke with guest curator Michelle Steinwald about this year's Catspan Cultural Park Festival in Tivoli. She'll talk about the artists she's bringing together and what folks can expect.
Good morning. This is Valerie Manzi, and it's time again for the annual festival at Catspan Festival Park in Tivoli. Today we have Michelle Steinwald, curator and former dancer and choreographer, and she's here to tell us all about this festival. It is on three consecutive Saturdays beginning in the end of August, and there really is a lot to learn about it. Sounds like... Hi, Michelle.
Thanks for having me. Yes, it's jam-packed. We wanted to make sure that, knowing that it's a trek sometimes to cross the river, we want to make sure people have plenty to enjoy and worth the travel all the way to Tivoli.
And can you tell us a little bit about the festival itself, what kinds of events there'll be, the dates?
So it's three Saturdays in a row. It's August 29th, which is the last Saturday before Labor Day weekend, and we're treating that day like a fairground. There are a lot of free activities during the day for all ages. We start at 11 o'clock in the morning with a bike maintenance workshop with one of our festival artists. We're doing a lacrosse stick handling clinic with the Bard women's lacrosse team. And we're building art in support of one of the plays that's happening the following weekend. We're making a wampum belt as part of Six Nations One Fire, their residency. And so that's some of the stuff happening during the day. And then we start with a dance performance with Capuli Danza Mexicana at 1 o'clock, performance about First Peoples dances from Mexico. And then we go into a ballet company, Ballez, doing travesty doll play. It's their version of Coppelia. And then we're doing a very special presentation by a choreographer, Brooklyn-based choreographer, Anna Sperber. She did a project during the pandemic on top of a roof that was 15,000 square feet. So a really immense, and this is the first time she gets to redo Bo Echo at that same scale for one of our fields at Catspan. So that's at 5 o'clock. And then we top off that first day of the festival with Valerie June, the singer-songwriter, blues, bluegrass, folk, pop. She's just one of a kind, and we're really, and that's just the first day of the festival. We really wanted everybody to feel welcome. There's something for everybody. All the shows are about an hour long, so you can see something, have a little break, and wander around the campus outside, and then come back for another performance. We'll have food trucks that Saturday, August 29th. And then Saturday, September 5th, we change speeds a little bit and we go into a playwrights platform. We have six different productions of plays, and typically...
Actually, let me stop you there so I could make a segue, sure. Okay?
Yeah.
Okay. It sounds like you have something for everyone on Saturday the 29th. Now, I'm looking at September 5th. And that looks quite a bit different. Tell us about that day.
Thank you. Yes. So we developed a playwright platform because last year was the first year I worked at Catspan, and I spent a whole month in Tivoli, and I was hearing from local artists. I was watching local audiences and their real interest in storytelling. And I had heard about all these different playwrights working on new material. And so I put together two programs. You'll have a chance to see three different productions in each of the programs, so a total of six productions, and hearing directly from the playwrights themselves. So it's a very intimate, community-based day where we get to not only sit in the audience and observe, but we'll be sitting next to other artists. And in the evening, we're going to have a party, of course. After having spent some time hearing all these playwrights, we're going to go into a sing-along with the Bearded Ladies. The Bearded Ladies Cabaret come from Philadelphia, and so they'll be singing, and there'll be a lot of call and response, and so the audience can get involved. And then right after that, Crickets, which is a electro-pop punk band, will be singing and doing their concert at the same time as one of the musicians, Roddy Bottom, who is one of the founding members of Faith No More from the, you'll remember, from the 80s. He has just put out a memoir, so he'll be reading from his memoir at the same time. So it's a day of stories, of being in community together, about seeing each other's work and interacting as a group, and having a really great dance party at the end.
Wow. And then we move on to the 12th.
Yes, the 12th
I see Friday, September 11th here.
So September 11th is we're having an artist talk. So some of the, because we have artists in residence, CUTSPON is primarily a residency center for artists. These artists are staying for a few days, sometimes a few weeks, and developing new work. So we have moments throughout the festival, like September 4th, one of our festival artists, Laura Curry, will be at the Tivoli Free Library giving an artist talk. So that's free and open to the public. That's part of Free Fridays in Tivoli. And then September 6th, we have an art walk with the curator and the visual artists from the visual exhibition, Earthly Delights. And then Friday the 11th, we have an artist talk with choreographers from Evidence and Masters at Work. So Ron K. Brown and Courtney Balenciaga Washington. So there are a few events that kind of spill over the sides of the Saturdays, because really having that time to talk with the artists and without the hustle and bustle of the festival. But the last day of the festival is Saturday the 12th, September 12th, and that is a big, beautiful program of gorgeous dancing from Evidence, West African contemporary dance, beautiful ensemble work, and then we go right into Masters at Work, Courtney Balenciaga Washington's dance company, where it is focused on ball and voguing and street dance. Is very tight choreography, both big, beautiful dancing companies. And then we close again with another concert, this time with choreographer Miguel Gutierrez, who does slowed down versions of Madonna songs. So everybody will recognize the Madonna songs. Miguel calls himself Sadonna. And we get to be swept away with the nostalgia and also the vulnerability of those beautiful songs that Madonna has written over the years. We recognize her strength and power, and by slowing the songs down, we get into the vulnerability and the tenderness. And we'll have a fire lighting at the end to have a little gratitude circle and celebrate the start of the fall.
Well, there's a lot to cover, and we did our best. But if anyone wants more information, you go to CUTSPON.org, CUTSBAAN.org. There's a lot going on up there in Tivoli.
Yes, indeed. We really welcome everybody to come. We hope you stay for a show, for two shows, or the whole day. There will be plenty to do. The downtown district in Tivoli is just right around the corner. It's a very walkable village. And so between CUTSPON and the amenities in Tivoli itself, it will promise a really beautiful day.
Well, have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to Valerie Manzi for that. That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. There is a flash flood watch in Ulster and Orange counties for this afternoon, as some thunderstorms coming in later this afternoon could bring some flash flooding to the area and localized damaging wind gusts. So be alert to that. We will talk to you tomorrow. I'm Tim Bruno. On Point is next. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Tavern on Main, where modern American cuisine meets classic favorites. Dinner, weekend brunch, craft cocktails, and warm hospitality on Main Street in Jeffersonville. More at tavernonmainny.com.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.